Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Clinical psychologist Dr. Tony Bates, good afternoon. Welcome back. Good to see you. Tony, we're going to talk today a little bit about our dark side and our secrets, and yes, then the antidote to that, which, and I know you're keen for the conversation not to be too dark, but we'll have to go through the darkness to get to the light, as you know. So vulnerability as the antidote to secrets. I suppose is Carl Jung is kind of the person we most associate with, yes, talking about our secrets and our dark sides and everything. What's his kind of thesis on
well,
it?
Well, Jung spoke about the shadow, which is that side of all of us that is really something, it's what we're not sure about, not proud of. It's those insecurities in ourselves that we don't really know what to do with, and we may feel ashamed of them, and so we repress them, we hide them away, and the shadow world is where we keep all of that stuff. And for Jung, this was really important to be aware of, because when we're not aware of the dark energies in ourselves, they tend to erupt when we least expect them, and can cause hurt. So he felt it was really important that we befriend them, that we get to know these sides of ourselves and take ownership of them, because if we don't own them, they're going to own us.
And I presume they're gaining power there all the time in the dark as well, if we're not acknowledging them.
I think what is unacknowledged begins to gather power. Freud felt that we could keep a check on them with the superego. You know, we could just have a strong no, you're not going to do that, you're not going to feel that, stop that. And the church, I suppose, for us growing up, relied on shame to keep us in check, to keep the shadow in check. But none of that really worked, because, again, shaming, forbidding, just things tend to come out in the most extraordinarily destructive ways.
So do we have it? We have it, not unique, because there are other deeply religious societies and everything. Do we have a particular issue with secrecy and our shadows because of Christianity and pious morality and stuff in this country?
Well, I think we do. I think that we, there's no doubt we need to be very honest with ourselves. We're all capable of the kind of stuff we hear on the news. I mean, at some level, all of us are capable of all kinds of destructive behaviour. And we need to be very clear about that. And we need to lose any sense of naivety that we're all beautiful human beings who would never do that kind of thing. No, in those circumstances, who knows what I would do?
Do you think we all do tend to go wrong these days? Kind of, you know, people talk about virtue signalling. Are we more inclined these days to go around pretending to be really nice people who don't have any of that old dark side stuff?
I certainly think that's the desirable image, that somehow there's a good way of living, there's a right way of eating, living, exercising, doing everything. And if you do that, you'll be just this kind of perfect human being. And it doesn't allow for the messiness of human life. I mean, all of us have some point in some way have made a mess of our lives. I mean, we've just done the wrong thing, or we've taken the wrong path. And that's been part of what brought us to today. So we can't erase that and say, well, now, if you didn't do that and didn't do that and didn't, you know, then you'd be the perfect human being. It doesn't work like that. I think we have to wrestle with all kinds of contradictory elements in ourselves, and we need to kind of make peace with them. I think what's forgotten is, where are we heading to with all of this? I think we're heading to becoming a much more rounded, integrated human being who has responsibility for what we feel and how we behave, and who is visible. That to become human is to become more and more visible. I'm here. What you see is me. And when I say I, there is someone behind that pronoun who is solid and, you know, real and authentic, and therefore you can feel safe with
for good and for bad.
Yeah, and yeah. I think
because the church had in a way a practical solution to all this, which I think did work for generations of people, which was the notion of the confession, where you kind of unburdened Absolutely. Yourself of your dark secrets.
It's interesting, in all every religious tradition, in every path to enlightenment, whether it's East or Western traditions, they all require a certain reckoning with the truth. We all have to admit where we've been and who we are. We have to confess. And really what that is we have to look at ourselves and recognise elements in ourselves that are perhaps a bit wayward, or, you know, that we're just not sure what to make of them. So we have to confront ourselves first. And I mean, the church asked this of people, but also psychotherapy asked people to begin to be willing and open to discovering certain truths that are well buried about themselves so that they can move on. It's almost like until we kind of become honest with ourselves about what's really happening in our lives, we can't move on. And as long as we keep it a secret from ourselves or from others, we can be stuck with that. We get stuck.
Okay. You were put off confession from an early age, I believe, were you?
Oh, gosh. Oh, dear. I did mention that. I was a good Catholic boy who did everything in my power to be a good kid and served at Mass and did all that. But I had one or two sins, and nothing too devastating, but nonetheless, I was embarrassed as hell about them. I think I took some money from my mother's purse. And so I went from our local church, Marino, down to Fairview to find a kind of an anonymous priest and tell him, you know. So I crept into what were the adult confessions at the time. There was no children there. And I sat in the pew, and then my turn came, went into the confession box, and I told him, you know. And he just let out in a roar, you know, is it heaven or hell you're heading for? You know, and the whole church heard it and imagined I had done something totally despicable. And then he told me I'd have to pay every penny back and that there would be no forgiveness until the last penny was. And, you know, it probably took about 8p or something, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, I went out and that was it. I don't think I ever went back to confession again.
That particular avenue of unburdening was
yes,
closed
yeah, I
here
had to
after
turn
that.
To psychology
yeah.
then. Yeah.
Your mother burdened you with a big secret when you were young, didn't she?
Oh, my mum, yeah, she... Well, well, she.
Are you uncomfortable with?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what we're referring to, Brendan. To be perfectly honest,
I understood that your mother's kind of mental health
oh, yes.
issues
yeah,
and
yeah,
stuff
yeah.
were a source of big secrecy.
Oh no, yeah, no. She, oh yes, absolutely. No, she was the woman while being escorted by two neighbours out the door to St. Pat's, when in 1965, I remember her just turning to me and saying, "Now, not a word, not a word to my father, who was in the Lebanon at the time, and not a word to the relatives in Cork, all her family, not a word to anybody."
Because that was the thing that mattered.
Yeah, that yeah. was it, that she was so ashamed, whilst at the same time claiming she was simply going in to have her white blood cell count rectified. Apparently it had fallen low. I it didn't make any sense, but she was ashamed. The same woman, in fairness, just to balance that, 2 years later was listening to Billy Wynne from Monkstown, the cleric who set up some kind of a telephone support service in the basement, because he'd heard about this group called the Samaritans, and she heard this on the radio, and she said to herself, "That's what I need." And with two other women, they set up the Samaritans in Ireland, and they co-founded the first, what was the Dublin branch. And it grew then into the national movement that it is. So she learned, I suppose, from her forced silence and shame. She learned that that was not how to deal with our mental health issues or our vulnerabilities, and she did something about it for people.
Yeah.
And it was.
It reminds me actually of I was talking to. Dr. Suzanne Crow yesterday, who is a paediatric intensive care specialist. Yeah. And she had a terrible tragedy in her own life, yeah. and a child who died, grief completely wiped her out and everything.
Yes.
But what got her back into the light again, if you will, was to put meaning on what had happened by yes. doing something about it for other people. So that's obviously a useful path yeah. for struggles in life, is it, that if you can put some meaning on it by, as your mother did, by helping other people out of it?
Yeah, I think, you know, where life wounds us is it's where we are vulnerable. And our vulnerability reveals a lot about our particular sensitivities and our particular of what really matters to us. And I think my mother was very deeply wounded by a kind of an enforced silence. It had been there for years. There was many other things that she wasn't really allowed to talk about. And that was just whatever that was. It was just the last straw.
Yeah.
But I do think that she became then vehement about people's need to be able to talk to each other. And it's a small thing. But for her, yeah. that was life and death issue. And it was a life and death issue for many. And
going back to you as a child yeah. then, though, being told that, not a word, and my characterization of it at the beginning through you, but it was you as a child being told, okay, you need to hold this thing. And I think we all know that secrets and children can be an awful thing. They were like, yeah. if you ever had the experience of a child, like it's a terrible pain in their stomach, like, and nobody can figure out what it is. And
then but there's something
that it's something that they are feel unable
something
to say.
That's happening in the family that nobody could talk about because it's just not going to be okay with mom or dad or whoever. And we mustn't say that thing. And children know, even if it's not very explicit, they know what they don't know. They can feel it and they register it. I remember having a family I saw in James's and there was five of them. There's all kinds of stuff going on. But the younger one, the 13, would bedwet. And she was the one who I would always go to in terms of saying, what's happening in this family? You know, and her bedwetting was kind of a powerful message to me. And then she would speak. And then she would say what's happening. And she was always the one who spoke the truth. So, yes, children register things deeply and they feel them and they go along with these crazy kind of secretive behaviours or alliances or conspiracies.
Yeah.
So as
yeah.
not to upset someone. And I think it really takes its toll. I mean, secrets generally, young call them poison. And I think we all have secrets, let's face it. And some secrets are fine to have and some secrets are to do with the past and they're best left there and end of story. But the secrets he's talking about are secrets that are still very alive. They have voltage and they're okay. in my body and I can feel them. And I don't...
So they are like trauma kind of...
They're like little yeah. mini traumas and they do damage to my health. And one of the extraordinary studies done by... what's his name? I forget it now and I worked with him for a while. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But he did a study on getting people... Just for a week, he had students right across the university over many, many samples. He had them write out for 20 minutes what they held as a secret in their life and what was most troubling to them right now. And for 20 minutes, anonymously in a laboratory, they just wrote out a journal. And then he collected the journals and he analysed them very carefully. And what he found was that over 5 days, found two things. One, initially it was all a bit kind of random and disorganized. But as time went on, people began to give shape and meaning to what they were experiencing. And they began to get insight, they began to see, yeah, I'm feeling this way because I can see it makes sense. And the second thing was he followed them up for 6 months and had a random control sample. And he found that their visits to the doctor decreased, their all kinds of health indices improved dramatically, and then repeated it and found the same studies, the same results. So I think there's something that we do ourselves a favour when we can speak the truth. As the Shakespeare said, the grief that does not speak whispers the o'erfraught heart and bids it break. the grief that does not speak. So I think it is powerful that we can disclose. And I think most of us are looking for even one person in the world that we can trust enough to be honest with about what's really going on. And that's such a gift.
And if that person doesn't judge you or react with horror, the shame will lift.
I think there is an extraordinary healing if that happens. I think we become able to look at something, to carry something, to take care of something. And that is very important.
I'm jumping around a bit now, but you brought up the journaling, and I do notice a lot of people have said to me in the last few years that they've become devotees of even 10 minutes of journaling in the morning. You sit down and write down whatever's on your mind, yeah?
It is powerful. You know, we need to disclose. We talk about, it's very important to talk to someone if you're troubled, but I don't think we often ask, why is that important? And what the hell does that, it's not going to make any difference. Life is still life. Well, I think what happens is first I hear myself when I speak. I begin to acknowledge this is a difficulty for me and I may not like that. I may hate it. I may be embarrassed and disappointed in that. But suddenly I'm hearing myself say it. It's real and I'm beginning to take responsibility. And the other thing is that when it's said, it loses a lot of its voltage, a lot of its power, and it becomes from being something shameful that stuck in my body, it becomes something workable that I can begin to take care of and nurture in some way.
And if you don't have that someone to talk to, will writing it down?
I think writing is very, very close. Yeah. Writing confession and just doing yourself a voice memo, just actually recording something.
And do you listen to it afterwards?
I think you can. And maybe if you're very lucky, somebody else might listen and who could actually really hear you and, you know, be compassionate.
But the act of doing it?
I think the act of doing it itself is very releasing and very revealing. And
the fact of how much it scares me, the idea of doing it, suggests that it must be a powerful thing.
I think all of this is saying, look, you know, move towards it. I mean, that was Jung's main contribution was, look, he said the hardest thing in the world is to accept yourself, and it's the most difficult journey we all make, and we make it slowly and hauntingly, and it's over years. But the end point of it is that we're more unified and we're more visible and we're more real in the world. And that's what we're heading to. I think just to add one little thing that I think is helpful to people, because one of the questions for me around all of this is, well, how can I be with my vulnerability? How can I be with this stuff? Because secrets are often a disguise for my vulnerability. Just a funny joke. I was talking to a chap on the beach the other day, and he's talking about house decorations. And he said to me, Tony, you know, you walk into a house, and he said, generally, what you see is what people are trying to hide. And the more garish the wallpaper, the more you know there's a big stain behind that.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, it's such an image of us, you know, where we really project the most positive image of ourselves is where we are probably most vulnerable, actually.
That's a good thing to remember about other people as well, isn't it? Because, you think everybody else is
they think they're fine,
super
but
confident
actually,
and all that. But, yeah.
No, I think they're not fine, but I do think that the being with vulnerability is, I think, one of the secrets of mental health, and maybe the most fundamental task. It's not actually feeling good; it's about actually how to handle feeling bad.
And so, the first step, then, you mentioned that powerful word acceptance, but the first step is to be honest with ourselves
Anagram is RAIN. It's from the mindfulness literature, Tara Brach. Other people have used, lots of people have used it. RAIN, R-A-I-N. And R is for recognize. Recognize that I'm upset, that I'm, troubled, that I'm hurting, that I'm repressing something. I'm, you know. Number two, A, allow. Allow it to be there. Allow that very uncomfortable feeling to be there. Yes, it'll momentarily rise and get more intense.
And in the body.
In the body. Let it be there. And notice where it is. And notice what colour it is. Notice what words you have. It may be anxiety. It may be sadness, anger.
So name it.
Name it insofar as you can, to find a word or to find what is that felt sense in my body. That's really powerful if you can. And then the I That's recognize, allow. The I is inquiry, to ask, to sort of step back a little and just say, this is interesting. I mean, this is happening out of the blue, and yet it isn't out of the blue. Something else has happened, or there's a context. So what was happening in my environment or in my conversations recently, and what was it that triggered this? And what insight maybe can I have, therefore, about where I'm really vulnerable, you know?
And just be fascinated by it.
Be fascinated by it, exactly. And then the final one is probably the most important, N, or A-I-N. N is for nurture. So how can I take care of this? This is, Thich Nhat Hanh used to say, our stormy emotions, our troubled emotions are not the enemy. They're our baby. And it sounds trite, but it's very powerful.
Go on.
Because they are our baby. They need minding. They need to be held. They need to be spoken to gently and softly. They need to be carried. They won't disappear all of a sudden. Like a child crying doesn't stop when you pick them up. Well, if they do, then you're very lucky. But often it takes time.
So how do I do that?
How do you hold yourself?
I think hold those emotions, yeah.
I think for me, I mean, I'm okay. Nick Cave talks about vulnerability as being the capacity to see in others the quivering mess that we are, all of us, in ourselves. So I'm that quivering mess sometimes. And I'd certainly sit with that experience. That's what I do. I go back and I sit and I go through that process. And it feels very much that what I'm feeling is being allowed to surface and to sit around the table of consciousness with all my other parts of me, some happy, some good, some fine, but not perhaps this particular one. And then just to stay with that and kind of almost dialogue with it, you know, just talk to myself, talk to and fro, talk from that feeling. What is that feeling trying to communicate? What is it saying? How am I listening? And then eventually asking the question, what might help or who might help, you know? And so I think that is, I think that's the work we have to do in mental health. It's the work of following the path of heartbreak, and it's not about feeling good and wonderful.
Don't push it away.
To the other side of it.
Okay. You say you can often see that a person is carrying a secret.
Did I? Okay. People think psychologists
can read
minds,
yeah.
But actually,
when someone walks in the room, though, can you tell a lot from how they carry themselves?
Yes,
into
I think
the room,
you know, you become very sensitive to the degree to which somebody is present when they walk into a room, the degree to which they're open, the degree to which they're kind of grounded, and their body isn't twitching, and they're not looking elsewhere. They're not kind of talking rapidly, talking too quickly. They're not overly grumpy. That there's something that they're bringing, which is a kind of themselves in that moment, and they're able to be with me or other people in the room. I think that's, and when somebody can't do that, and when they seem distracted or distant or alienated in some way, you'd sense there's something troubling them. What that is, I have no idea, but you just sense there's something up.
Okay, yeah. So what I get from it all is that it takes an enormous amount of energy, even thinking of that person coming in, and taking an enormous amount of energy and grinding our gears down to hold all this stuff
exhausting.
Down. And then, so the light then, vulnerability, which traditionally can have been regarded as weakness, is vulnerability actually strength?
Vulnerability is our superpower. It is our greatest strength, because it's what allows us to connect with ourselves and with each other in a compassionate way. And nothing is more powerful than that, because that's where resilience comes from. That's where real clarity and purpose and energy and empowerment come from, those connections. So I think vulnerability is particularly it's particularly important in close relationships, because I think vulnerability and intimacy are kind of dance partners, and they each guide the other. The greater the intimacy, the greater somebody can be vulnerable. But the greater somebody can be vulnerable, the more they can, the more close they can feel, and the more intimate that relationship can be. So vulnerability is powerful. And, you know, again, it's not about jumping in and just opening your entire heart. Right.
No, the trauma dump, as
it, you know, no, it's not about a trauma dump. It's about, it kind of starts with, you know, I don't really understand tracker mortgages. It's that kind of start, you know, just admitting that you don't have everything sorted. You don't have an opinion on every single world issue at the moment. Some of them, in fact, you find so complex and so bewildering, you don't know what to say. So it's about being willing to say who I'm not and what I'm not and what I don't know, rather than to project, I have it sorted. And that's the very basic kind of description of vulnerability. And that's, you can do in the pub. You know, it's not. And then in more intimate relationship, it's about talking with someone, not about you make me feel. I think the most important thing in vulnerability is that you talk in the first person. It's, I feel a bit bothered by something I'd like to talk about, or I feel upset when this kind of thing happens. I don't know why, but I'd love to kind of get my head around it. And that's why when you said something, it sort of really was hard for me. I was just in a very vulnerable place. So that's the kind of conversation between friends.
And it even feels, when you say it, like you're opening up to, to the world instead of like holding it all together.
You have a chance to move through it and let it go.
And our job when someone gives us the privilege of doing that to us is just to listen,
I think that's, I suppose that's been the, that's been what I've loved in my life. I mean, I've had a career where people have been willing to be vulnerable and tell me secrets. And most of those have not been dark energies. They've been very human, very painful, you know, issues that people have carried for years and worried about. And it is extraordinary to see people who become unguarded and begin to reveal what's really happening. It is one of these extraordinary moments in life when you feel, you see the beauty in human beings. And I think for me, more and more, and as a result of my career, I believe in the beauty and the goodness of human beings. I'm not in there to try to find some dark, shadowy energy that's, you know, when our emotions get all twisted up inside, we're capable of all kinds of hurt and hurting other people. And that's important to recognise. But there is a goodness in people, and it is beautiful to see it. And I've had that privilege, real privilege. Yeah, okay. And for anybody who that is sharing with you, just listen and never imagine that it's silly or that it's, because it's taken great courage for them to say that. And they're not proud of what they feel, and they may feel deeply ashamed of it, but they know that somehow holding it inside is keeping the relationship stuck. I'm not being me with you, and therefore we're not, we have a kind of superficial harmony, but we're not really connecting. So it is a great gift. And I remember a therapist I saw for years, and whenever I'd say something kind of vulnerable and open, her response was always, thank you. And I always remember, wow, that was a lovely thing to say.
30 seconds before you go. All this is in the body. The power of a good cry.
The power, there's nothing, weeping intensely is probably as close to enlightenment as any of us. It is just the most extraordinary liberating thing. And to be able to do that with someone, I mean, that's a special person. And so just let go, let it go.
Let go, let it go, let go, let go. Tony Bates, magic as always. And lots of text there. I can see people got a lot out of that. Thank you for being so present and thoughtful and useful today. And we'll take a break.
Email brendan@rte.ie.